Good morning and welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Agriculture news is often ignored by the mainstream media until something goes wrong, the salmonella outbreak, for example. We do this at our own peril because we all have to eat. So in our own small way, we'll start to correct that by putting some questions about agriculture to Dr. Warren Gill, Chair of the Department of Agribusiness and Agriscience here at MTSU, and Dr. Justin Gardner, an assistant professor in that department. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Indeed. Let me start out with the issue of farm subsidies, if that's all right with you guys. The Obama administration has proposed more than $16 billion in cuts to subsidies. The Farm Bureau Federation and 38 other groups have written Congress to oppose those cuts. But the administration claims farmers who earned more than $2.5 million between 2003 and 2006 got $49 million worth of subsidies. So is there an imbalance in the way that subsidies are issued? And how can the government ensure that the subsidies get to the farms and the farmers that need it the most?
I'll start the answer with a kind of a broad overview, then I'll let Dr. Gardner fill in the details, because he's the ag economist, these farm subsidies have been around for a very long time. Mm-hmm. They have been at least part of the reason why we are one of the most productive agricultural countries in the world. It's been argued that we feed the world. That's maybe not as true as it was once upon a time, as the rest of the world has caught up, and it's truly an international picture. But the development of the subsidies, growing out of the Great Depression and becoming stronger as we got into the 50s and 60s, have been at least a part of the reason why we are so efficient, part of the reason why we spend such a small percentage of our money, of our income, on food. Compare not only to not only to other places in the world. Maybe I better let Justin.
Well, while Warren's coughing, okay. let me give you a number. Roughly speaking, about who you ask and when you ask, that in the United States, we spend somewhere between 10% and 15% of our income on food. If you look at some place like Nigeria, that number is closer to 75%. Mm-hmm. So food as a part of your household budgetary expenditure may seem like a lot, but when you compare it to your house payment, your car payment, how much you spend on fuel, how much you spend on insurance, it's relatively small. In regard to the overall federal budget and the role of the Farm Bill as part of that, I have something in front of me right here from farmpolicy.org. They're probably a little bit one-sided, but they cite the Congressional Budget Office, which probably isn't one-sided. According to their analysis of the Congressional Budget Office data, the 2007 Farm Bill spending was a little less than 2% of the federal budget. Of that, the commodity programs, these big subsidies, that's less than 0.25%, about 0.25% of the federal budget. Now, how much of that is large farms making more than $2.5 million? Well, some smaller number, obviously. It's my opinion that, well, you can't find those handful of farmers who are getting a large subsidy and cut their subsidy and fix the federal budget. Mm-hmm. But it sure does sound nice in this radio world of sound bites that we live in to say, well, here's this farmer who's got a very large payment. Why don't we just go after that person?
Does the distribution of the subsidies need to be changed so that the little farmer gets more than what he's getting now?
That sounds like a good idea, but you have to remember that people are self-interested, and they'll change how they organize their farm if you do that. Take some large farm that's getting a large subsidy and give them a cap. You make more than XYZ million dollars, or XYZ $100,000, you can't get a subsidy bigger than some number, pick any number you want. Well, that's real easy to fix. That big farm's probably a very large family farm, and we'll just split the operation into about three. The daughter will have part of it, my son will have part of it, I'll have part of it, and then we'll all get the same subsidy. So what good's that going to do? I don't really think that. I think it's a red herring is what I think.
Okay.
It does, it makes people real suspicious when they see these very big numbers going out to a corporate farm. Mm-hmm. But just to emphasize what he's saying, a lot of times these corporate farms are simply family farms who, with advice of their attorney or their tax preparer or whatever, they have incorporated, and they're really still a family farm or a multifamily farm, and they employ a lot of people. They employ a significant number of people. They're larger operators that are a business, and this is part of their business plan. And so I agree with Dr. Gardner in that it's not as simple as the politicians would have us believe.
So there's not really a correlation or as much of a correlation as people would have you think between the farm subsidy distribution system and the relative disappearance of the small family farm in America.
Right.
Right. I would think that's fair to say.
Okay. Fair characterization. And that's also, it would also be fair to say, you know, the farm bill and this whole system is always a work in progress, because there have been times, you know, to be fair, that some people have worked the system. You know, they worked it so that perhaps they did gain an unfair advantage, and usually when that's happened, it's been figured out, and so then adjustments get that's why we have a new farm bill every 5 years, is to look for those inequities, those places where imbalances do occur, and so that may be the place where the politicians, our political community does need to play a role, is to look for those places where maybe some inequities do exist, and go for them. I've seen that work very well in some situations where some imbalances have occurred. I'll give an example. Because I've worked more with the sheep business, and there was a number of years ago, there was a sheep incentive program that, frankly, it kind of got maneuvered by a few people, and where truly there were some people that had really very little to do with the sheep business. They were investors who invested in the sheep business simply because it had a very beneficial government payment that went along with it, and that got out and it got adjusted very significantly, and the sheep business shifted back more into real sheep producers doing real sheep production, and so it got adjusted in the right direction.
Okay. There seems to be a little confusion, at least in my mind, about who's in charge when it comes to food safety, the USDA or the FDA, and how does this bureaucracy affect the farmer whose livestock and fruits and vegetables are being inspected? How does he keep up with the regulatory kudzu?
There are three federal agencies that regulate agriculture, the USDA, the FDA, and the EPA. You know, when we're talking about agricultural production, lots of waste, lots of chemicals, the EPA steps in to regulate that. And so that's the first organization that a farmer has to contend with. Which is a real good idea, because we need to protect our environment from any damages that might happen in all industries. And that's not just an ag-specific problem by any measure. The other two would be the USDA and the Food and Drug Administration. The Food and Drug Administration, their job is to, in essence, make sure the food is safe. That's their main job. They're concerned with the labeling, these kinds of things, what you can and can't put on a label. And the USDA, they do a lot of inspecting and grading as well as food safety. So there are two food safety agencies that our food supply has to go through.
And when you get into places like the recent peanut scare, where something breaks down, I think that's when you have to, you know, and we're all worried about food safety. I think that's one of the hot issues that is out there, rightly so, when people are getting sick. So you wonder, you know, where did the system break down? And it's certainly been instructive to me because of the peanut situation in Georgia. I sat down with one of our regulators with the state and said, what in the world went wrong? And essentially, I think that in that particular situation, the state was waiting for the federal to do something, and the federal thought the state was doing something. that it points out, you know, to go to your question, if there's not coordination between the organizations, and it's a little bit of the flaw of having too many cooks stirring the pot. Then, so he pointed that out. But then I said, can that happen in Tennessee? He said it probably could not, because our department has been so aggressive in going after that thing, those kind of things. So made me feel a lot better about what our department does.
Okay. I know a man who lives on the outskirts of Rutherford County who makes a living just by repairing old farm equipment. That's all he does. He repairs farm equipment. So how is the credit crunch affecting the farmer's ability to obtain the equipment that they need these days? Farm equipment's pretty expensive.
Is he repairing or is he restoring?
He is repairing. I mean, he does have an antique tractor on his property, but it's just for show.
I think in general, the ag credit's very good. I've been in interaction with them, and I don't see any problems at all. You just
what you have to remember is that farmers have property, and most banks like having property as a collateral. So your typical farmer that's running a reasonably profitable operation doesn't have much trouble borrowing money. If anything, they've got the ability to borrow far too much money. Wouldn't you agree that's probably the biggest problem?
I would say that that's probably true, but also the farm situation got bad in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. There was a maybe a little bit of what is happening to the credit system now nationally happened in the early 80s to the farm situation, and it was real tough. But out of that, and several, like the agricultural credit had some kind of implosion. They did not work very well. It was real tough there for a while. Mm-hmm. The general economy was bad, but the farm economy was worse. But out of that, we came through, I think, with a more conservative farm credit situation. And that more conservative situation is, I think, boosting us right now. The ag credit situation is probably not nearly as bad as the general credit situation. I farm myself on the side, and I've detected no problem in getting the operating funds that I need, nor have I picked up that even though I'm a small operator, the larger operators I think are still doing just fine.
So it's better for farmers than it is for the general public.
There are some problems. One thing, some of the prices, commodity prices, dairy prices right now right now we're at break even or below on dairy commodity prices. There's some other issues that are making it tough for farmers. You might want to expand on that.
Well, one of the big issues is input prices right now have been high. Fertilizer, commercial fertilizers, we basically use natural gas to make that. And as oil prices and natural gas prices all spiked last year, well, the input cost for farmers went up dramatically as well. Mm-hmm. That was wasn't so bad because we also had some record spikes in our outputs, our corn and soybean prices, these kinds of things. But you're a farmer and you finally get a year with high prices and your fertilizer was so expensive you weren't really able to make any nice profits, and that's kind of harsh.
Yeah.
I think the general economy has made been a factor in bringing some of these prices down too. Calf prices are lower than they should be. If you just look at supply and demand issues, calf prices ought to be in better shape than they are, but people are just not wanting to spend as much for mm-hmm. beef in the stores. So the farmers are not unaffected by the general economy, but our credit, just to go to the original question, our credit is not maybe as bad as the general economy.
The nation of Chile is running commercials on national cable television networks these days to encourage Americans to buy their fruit. What kind of an impact are the imports of fruits and vegetables having on the American farmer?
That's been happening for a long time. This is not a recent. Chile has been a player for, golly, they're getting into the second, well into the second decade of that. So it's I don't think that that's been a a big surprise. You know, so we kind of accommodated. It's a global economy. I think that American farmers have recognized and are figuring ways to compete in this global economy very well. It definitely changes how we do certain things. I know more about animal agriculture than the fruits and vegetables, but Argentina, New Zealand, Australia, these countries compete very well. They can grow cattle very efficiently. It's mostly grass based. One thing they can't do though is compete on the upper end market. We're much better at growing corn and feeding corn raising grain fed beef. And so we compete very well in a niche that they don't compete. So we find those things that we do the best and go there and then learn to survive in the other parts of the economy. Yeah.
It's very easy to take a look at a producer in another country, whether it's cars or fruit or corn, and say, oh, hey, they're making it cheaper than we are, and we're bringing into our country and displacing jobs here. And that's just, you know, a fact of the economy. You know, the place where we can get it cheapest at is where we'll get it from. If you're in Tennessee and you're listening to this, you probably shouldn't be too concerned about fruit from Chile coming into the United States from a standpoint of how it's going to harm agriculture or impact prices of food. Now, if you're in California or Florida, you're a little bit less happy about it. But you know, for consumers in Tennessee, it's, you know, whenever we get freer trade with fruits and vegetable products, which are, you know, we traditionally tend to import those, or they come from those, you know, California, Florida kind of states. It's going to lead to lower food prices for the consumer. There's no safety issues with their food because it's all inspected just like the stuff here is. Mm-hmm. So there's really nothing to be too worried about it for the most part if you're in Tennessee.
The average farm size in Tennessee last year went from 201.7 acres down to about 178.3. What's going on with that? Are the developers building more subdivisions, everybody wanting to move from the suburbs into the exurbs, or what is causing this?
Well, Justin has some details on that. I think you know, the basis of your question, as farmers, they kind of a natural evolution that's gone on the last few years. Farmers get old, and they've worked hard all their lives. They've done all the things right to stay in the business, and they're farming a significant amount of land, and that land has gotten a lot more valuable just the natural increase in land prices. If they're closer to a city like Nashville or Murfreesboro, that acceleration in value has been dramatic. Or in the Columbia, the Murray County area, when you've had a huge industry that has come in, and frankly, Murray County got carved up to a large degree into smaller farms as these people who with significant incomes came in and they want to own a few acres and put a few horses out there. So mm-hmm. so we have seen these mini farms developing, and so Justin, would you
what were your numbers again?
It was 201.7 down to 178.3.
And that's the number of farms or the size of
average farm size,
average
as well
farm
as in Alabama
acres?
And Georgia.
Okay, well, I've got some data I just got this morning. Tennessee Agriculture 2008 is my source. It's a report that the Tennessee Department of Ag puts out annually. In 2002, the average farm size was 134 acres. In mm-hmm. 2007, it was 144 acres.
So your figures are saying it actually went
and
up.
And if you take a look at your numbers, right, what were they again?
201.7 down to 178.3.
Down to 170. That sounds like a pretty dramatic decrease, but I would say that if you were to do some hypothesis testing, you would see that it's probably not statistically significant, which is why you might get conflicting reports mm-hmm. from a different source. You know, the farm getting smaller or bigger is just a result of the farm responding to economic pressure. It's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just a thing.
Well, it seems anecdotally that the farmers, a lot of people who choose to stay on the farm have a lot more non-farming neighbors than they used to.
I think that would probably be fair. Or, some of these, non-farming neighbors, it's a little bit difficult to characterize because I might think that maybe some of my neighbors where I farm, I'm not there every day. I don't farm. I'm here at MTSU. And yet we raise 80 cows, and that feeds a significant number of people. And I meet any definition of a farmer, that's usually something like sells $1,000 worth of product a year.
The potential to sell $1,000 worth of product is actually the USDA's definition.
So actually some of these non-farm farmers are farming pretty significantly. And so, again, you get into some definition things it's just the plain economics. I could go farm full time, mm-hmm. and would not make near as much income as I do farming part time.
It all depends upon who's defining terms and crunching the numbers.
Exactly,
and that leads to a really important point. If you look at agriculture in the country nationwide, mm-hmm. you know what a bell-shaped curve is, right? You typically think if you go out and count a bunch of people, measure how big their farm is, it looks like a bell, right? Uh-huh. The spot in the middle is where you have the largest number. And what's happening is the distribution of farms is becoming bimodal. Instead of a one-hump camel, it's a two-hump camel. Mm-hmm. Basically, what we see happening is that farm in the middle is deciding that they either need to get really big so they can make farming efficient and profitable, or they're deciding they need to scale back on their operation and supplement their income with something off farm. And so that's what the real trend is. And I'm not quite sure how the average farm size plays into that, because different types of farming operations need different sizes mm-hmm. in order to be efficient. But that's what you really see happening. You see this kind of divergence from, some farms are getting bigger, others are getting smaller, and the ones in the middle are the ones that are diminishing in number right now.
One thing that, I think that is important for us to keep in mind is how our students are fitting in and learning about this system and what kind of future that the ag students have in operating in this.
We're going to let Justin go ahead as Dr. Gill deals with his continuing cold.
Agriculture is constantly becoming more and more technical. The technology is constantly becoming more and more advanced. It's not just some farmer on a little tractor plowing one or two rows at a time. We've got massive equipment with GPS. You've got a wide array of agricultural chemicals, and not just chemicals, but alternative pest methods. Integrated pest management is the term where you're using things like pheromone traps in cotton to catch boll weevils, this kind of thing. And the technical aspects of agriculture is increasing at a very rapid pace, which means we need smarter farmers for the future.
What about the promotion of colleges that teach agriculture? Institutions like Auburn and Texas A&M over the years have gotten labeled cow colleges, disparagingly so. Is that diminishing? Are you getting the respect you deserve?
I think so. I feel there's as we've looked at budget type situations, and I think that's kind of given us a renewed chance to point out the importance of agriculture. I may be a little dated on my figures on it, but about 20% of the jobs that are available in the United States are agriculture related. Food processing. Food processing is a huge industry. You would talk about food safety. Just the food safety part of the food processing industry is extremely large, and that's a lot of what we are preparing our students for. Is things like dairy processing. People don't realize that dairy processing itself is a $1.5 billion industry. In fact, Dr. Gardner found those numbers. Would you expand mm-hmm. on that?
Right, yeah, I've found some numbers. Roughly speaking, we're looking at a $1.5 billion industry just in the state of Tennessee, with something on the order of 2,300 jobs. These mm-hmm. are people who are know, taking the milk from the farm and processing it so that you can put it in a jug and we can drink it. That's the type of thing we're talking about. Mm-hmm. If you look at Rutherford and Davidson counties, about a third of that activity are in these two counties. Oh, which is really important for us here at MTSU because we are the only university in the state that has a milk processing facility on campus. People from industry can come to our facility and learn how to process milk, learn how to do it better.
See the MTSU milk truck every day.
That's exactly right. We've got the only place where you have all the equipment in one room. It's all smaller scale than you would see at someplace like Heritage Farms or Purity Dairies. But everything he needs in one room. So someone can come in and learn, you know, stand in one spot and just spin around. Here's what this machine is. Here's what it does. Here's why it's important. Here's a spot where you've got to have positive pressure because you don't want the milk running backwards because then you spoil the whole batch kind of stuff.
Everything except the cow.
Some people don't realize that that Murfreesboro is the home of the largest yogurt processing plant in the world. General Mills at Yoplait, just south of town.
I did not know that.
A lot of people don't realize that, and that's one reason we think, if anything, we're going to increase our food processing program in the ag department because it's so important. It's important that our students know, you know, how to milk a cow. It's probably even more important that they know the importance of this food processing, food safety, all the issues related to that.
Let's talk about genetically modified foods. Are they the future of agriculture and of food production or not? Where do you guys come down on that?
I did my dissertation on the economic impacts of genetically modified organisms in agriculture, and so I know quite a bit about them. I don't think they're the future. It'd be more accurate to say they're the present. At this point in the game, they're also the past. If you've eaten anything fried in the last 10 years, it was probably fried in soybean oil, which comes from virtually all the soybeans grown in the United States are genetically modified. There's a trait called Roundup Ready. Roundup is a chemical made by Monsanto. And so Roundup Ready soybeans, you can spray this chemical on the field and it will, you know, get rid of the weeds. It's a great weed control measure, but it won't harm the soybean plants. And actually, from an environmental standpoint, this is quite good. I did a nice little paper on this, actually. Roundup is, relatively speaking, much less toxic than virtually any other chemical that you would use in that situation. It's a low toxicity chemical, and so we've replaced various forms of weed control, mechanical weed control, which means burning fossil fuels, with this chemical that, after it's been in the ground for a few weeks, is completely inert and it's relatively not toxic. And so we've switched to that cropping system, and we've gotten some environmental improvements from that. Not tilling the soil helps quite a bit. When you till the soil, it's easier for it to run off.
So you would disagree with the European characterization of these foods as Frankenfoods?
Yes, I would. And just to give you some history on this, Europeans are...
Very briefly, because we have less than a minute to go.
Europeans don't trust their food safety program. It all comes from the mad cow disease. We found mad cow disease in Britain, and someone said, don't worry, no one's going to die from mad cow disease. And then someone died. Right? Yeah. Now, would you trust your food safety system if they told you no one was going to die and people started dying?
Right.
I think the threat for mad cow has probably been a little bit overblown. On the face of the earth, there's been less than 170 people who died from mad cow disease, and it's, you know, now it's horrible when someone gets it because it's a certain death. But from an overall big picture of food safety, we've got billions of people in the world. It's had relatively little impact on human safety, but it made the news. It made a big headline. Our food safety people are wrong. And so I think that's probably where a lot of the distrust comes from, in my opinion.
Dr. Justin Gardner, Dr. Warren Gill, thank you for teaching the students who are going to be producing our food and making sure it's safe. And thank you for being here today. This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can also catch us at mtsunews.com, where you can download the podcast. And we're also available on iTunes.